Welcome to the Check Your Head Podcast, the podcast where notable musicians and experts come and share their stories and solutions for mental health and wellness. I'm your host, Mari Fong, a music journalist and life coach for musicians, and we're continuing our celebration of love with Valentine's Day soon approaching, and we're also adding Black History Month to the mix. One of my favorite ways to learn about people in history is to read autobiographies. So two that I'm recommending are about two iconic Black musicians that changed the face of music, one being the great Sammy Davis Jr. and the other being the amazing Quincy Jones. So if you want to read a really good autobiography, pick up Yes, I Can, The Story of Sammy Davis Jr., or Q, The Autobiography of Quincy Jones. Both incredible stories by two incredible musicians. For Valentine's Day, we'll be celebrating by hearing part two of our interview with top psychiatrist and relationship coach, also popular on TV shows like Marriage Boot Camp and The Tamron Hall Show, and I call him the preacher of love, Dr. Ish Major. For a future musician today, I was so excited to land this interview because I have loved her music forever. She's a true icon, having earned 10 Grammy Awards, 2 Country Music Awards, an Emmy Award, a Golden Globe Award, and has received Lifetime Achievement Awards by both the Grammys and the Latin Grammys. This singer-songwriter was also inducted into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, with her career starting in the 60s with the Stone Ponies, and her solo career spanning decades with hits like Blue Bayou, When Will I Be Loved, and You're No Good. Our guest today is the one and only Linda Ronstadt, whose voice has carried her through so many genres of music, rock, pop, country, jazz, and one very close to her heart, singing Mexican folk songs, similar to the one she grew up singing with her family, led by her Mexican-European father. In 2013, Linda was diagnosed with a form of Parkinson's disease and retired from singing. Yet Linda continued to be a force of nature, telling stories through film instead of music. Her latest documentary, called Linda and the Mockingbirds, is about her trip to Mexico with Los Insontles, which translates to the Mockingbirds, a troupe of young Mexican singers and dancers from San Francisco traveling to Mexico to learn more about their culture and heritage. Joining Linda is her friend and fellow musician Jackson Brown, who's there to witness the stories behind the children who immigrate from Mexico to the United States and how Linda has become one of their advocates. So let's start with the great Linda Ronstadt sharing her story of mental wellness and resilience. I wanted to let you know that you have been an inspiration for me, and I wanted to thank you for your music. Aww. And, you know, you have had a long life and a career that has spanned so many decades. And yet, you know, we've all had our shares of ups and downs, both personally and professionally. When looking back, what were some of the greatest struggles of your life, or some of the downs that you can think of?
Well, I can't say really. I had a pretty good time. Being on the road is a little bit alienating. Makes it hard to maintain friendships. I somehow managed to keep my friends. I don't know why they put up with me. It's hard to interrupt your reality and go replace it with a month or two, and then go back and try to reassemble your life.
You know, you did mention that about the loneliness being on tour, which is something that a lot of musicians experience, you know, being away from family and friends. Do you think that was the most difficult part of being on tour, the loneliness, or was there something
else? Sometimes there was great camaraderie, you know. You get into a real groove with the band, and you get very insular. I think it's like Joseph Conrad's book, Heart of Darkness, at the beginning talks about how provincial sailors are. You think they're not provincial because they sail around the world, but they only go to the port and they only see the same things in every port: grog shops, prostitutes, people that hang around in those kind of places, and it's all the same. So we'd get very insular like that. We just see the sound check and the bus backstage. If it was good group dynamics, we'd have a lot of fun together because we became comrades.
Well, that's really good to hear.
you know, when people think about touring, they think about the parties and, you know, groupies and things like that. But, you know, you were a female lead in the 70s in a very male-dominated industry. And I know that there were a lot of male artists that really, you know, you collaborated with, but you were like a strong-willed, determined artist. How was that, you know, going up the ladder? Did you experience like comments or behaviors that really made it difficult for you as a woman, as a lead female woman?
Not particularly. I had a good manager. I was protected from a lot of that. You know, if I'd been on my own, maybe it would have been different. But I didn't. The guys in the band were like my brothers. They were nice.
That's really good to hear. In one of your interviews, you know, you did talk about depression and how it affected your life.
I don't think it was situational particularly. I think it was chemical.
Really? You think it was due to medication or a hormonal thing? Or
just going through different time zones and not being in the same place for very long. I think it can cause depression. I think the best way to fight it is with exercise.
Yeah, I think you were saying that running was an outlet for you, and that, you know, exercise was something that
your brain chemistry. You can do yoga and running and change your brain chemistry.
Yeah, you know, that is one thing, is that a lot of things can change your brain chemistry, you know, including like physical conditions. Like in 1997, you were diagnosed with Hashimoto's thyroiditis. Was that a condition that ever affected your mental health?
I was diagnosed with that when I was in my 20s.
Okay.
It made it hard for me to exercise sometimes, but I did it anyway.
Okay. So the exercise helped in that case?
Exercise helped a lot.
Okay. That's really good to hear. Now, one thing I read is that, you know, you got to a point in your career where you were singing at like big arena tours. And, you know, you mentioned that you had performance anxiety, which is something that is pretty common among, you know, musicians. Can you describe that anxiety and also what you did to kind of quell it so that you could perform to, let's say, a big crowd?
Well, I always performed. It wasn't a question of whether I did or not. I didn't like the big arenas because they didn't sound very good. You know, music has a lot of subtlety and nuance. And it's not possible to achieve in a big arena. I like playing smaller theaters, but that meant less money. So, but I changed. I would get bored with the music because I felt like I could do more. I wanted to sing Mexican music really badly. So I finally just started singing Mexican music and I was happy.
Yeah, you know, that I thought was so interesting because, you know, you had gotten so popular in so many different genres of music, you know, pop and rock and country. And, you know, then you wanted to go and sing Mexican songs. Now, how were you able to convince people to collaborate with you on this project when it was so different from what you had currently done?
Well, they thought it was a bad idea, but to their credit, I'm going to have a very good manager who co-produced the record with the head of the Mariachi Vargas in Mexico. And I knew the music. I knew what it was supposed to sound like. So he put his back into it. You know, he helped me do it. He didn't think it was a good idea, but he helped me do it because he realized it was important to me. And the record company thought it was a terrible idea, but to their credit, they promoted it. It turned out to be a big seller, so everybody was happy.
Yeah, it was called Canciones de mi Padre,
right?
Which is sort of like an ode to all the songs that, you know, you sang in your family, you know, led by your father. And it ended up being one of the best-selling non-English album in U.S. history. And that kind of leads me to your documentary, Linda and the Mockingbirds. You know, I saw both your documentaries. I saw, you know, the one about your life, The Sound of My Voice, and also Linda and the Mockingbirds. And I just got the sense that you weren't as interested in your own documentary, but was really interested in telling the story about, you know, the Mexican music, the song, the dance, the traditions, the history. Would you say that'd be true?
Well, I've been involved with this group for about 28 years, 29 years. I saw them singing on the street with little children. They're playing really, really well. They were playing really traditional songs from deep in Mexico that I knew the style of, and they were doing it right. And I was astonished because usually you see little kids beating their brains out trying to play music, and it sounds pretty good, you know, for little kids, but they sounded good. So mm-hmm. I stopped and asked them where they were from, and it turned out they were from the East Bay. And the person that was playing with them, the adult in charge, was Eugene Rodriguez, that had founded this cultural center called Los Insontles, which means the mockingbirds in Nahuatl. And he'd been teaching kids how to, real traditional ways of playing instruments, dancing, singing, and visual art. And it was an incredibly rich environment. I went to see it. They ran about 300 kids a week through that facility. And they didn't learn how to be performers necessarily. You didn't have to audition. It wasn't for the performing arts. It was for children to learn music and art so that they could express themselves and socialize with each other and connect with their grandparents' generation. So it connected families to intergenerationally. Also, those kids graduated from high school and college more frequently, and there was less teen pregnancy, and they weren't involved in gangs because the center gave them something to do after school. There was a place to do their homework. They had really healthy food. They had cooking lessons there. The families were very involved with the whole thing. I just thought it was the best music facility I've ever seen for music education.
Well, you know, when you went on that trip to Mexico and you sponsored, you know, the troop to go to Mexico to learn more about their heritage and so forth and continue with their dancing and their music, did you have the idea that you wanted this to be a documentary?
No, I had it by accident. The people that were doing the documentary on me had asked for an interview, and I said, you know, my whole life in interviews, I've said I'm Mexican-American, and they just kind of disregard. So I didn't want them to disregard the fact that I was Mexican-American and that Mexico was a huge part of my musical heritage and had a profound influence on my style. So I just said, if you want to interview me, you have to go to Mexico. So I was taking the kids, and they were taking a film crew because Eugene usually documents the stuff they do. And so it was going to take up too much room on the bus to take two film crews. So I said, well, we'll share a film crew. And so that's how James Keach got to know Eugene Rodriguez. And together they produced the documentary. I'd love to take credit for it because I think it turned out very nicely, but I really didn't have anything to do with it except I planned the trip.
Well, you did. I mean, you orchestrated everything, and you know, you did ask James Keach to go along with you, which is really pivotal, without, you know, thinking that it would be a documentary. So you're saying that it was actually his idea to create this story.
Yeah.
And to put it out.
Well, Eugene was already doing it. He just kind of took over Eugene's production.
Oh, I see. Okay, well, it was, you know, it was such a vibrant, just everything, the colors, the music, the energy, just the feeling behind all of it. I could just tell that you were like swelling with pride when you're looking at, you know, the families and the children that were getting back in touch with their heritage and learning more about their culture. So thank you so much for that.
Well, that part of their culture, there's so many different kinds of music and so many different cultures, so many different languages in Mexico. If you walk across the block, you change rhythm culture, you change language, you change style of dress, change kind of food. So they were getting in touch with northern Mexico, where I came from. I don't know if all of them came from there, but that's what we were doing.
Well, when you sang your Mexican songs, one thing that I really admired was that you really wanted to make sure that everything was really authentic and it was said properly and sang properly. And that was something really admirable. And I felt like, gosh, the notes that you would hold on these songs were just so long and beautiful. I was, you know, it was a part of your music that I got to know better as I was doing research on your story.
Those vocal traditions are very particular in Mexico. And I've always admired them and always loved hearing it. Took a little bit of woodshedding to get myself up to speed. So I knew how to sing the songs as a non-professional. My father sang them at home and I sang along with him, but I didn't always know all the words or know exactly how the phrasing worked.
Mm-hmm. One thing about Linda and the Mockingbirds that I thought was interesting was that there was also a commentary on immigration and what it's like for families to immigrate to the United States and some of the difficulties that are going on, you know, right now with our political climate. What are some of your thoughts on that?
Well, the Trump administration has initiated a policy of separating children from their families. It's a clearly cruel and punitive action. Lots of times families that are trying to come in legally that have come to the border and applied for asylum, they take them into detention right away while they're waiting to apply, and they take their children away from them. In many cases, take the children away from them in San Diego and fly them to New York City and put them in facilities they can't keep track. They weren't set up to keep track of these children. It was traumatic enough separating them from their parents, but then they lost who they were. They have hundreds of children that will never be reunited with their parents again because their parents were deported back to their own countries without them. And in many cases, they live in these little remote villages and don't even speak Spanish. They speak some indigenous language. It's just a terrible, terrible, terrible thing. Those children suffer greatly and permanently. And I think it violates all human rights laws. I'm surprised the United Nations hasn't come down on us for that. It's inexcusable. So when we were coming back across the border, we had a 2.5-year-old with us, my niece, and she was the pet of the tour. Everybody loved her. And I thought, what would happen if something happened? What would it be like if something happened? They found something they shouldn't find on the bus, or there was some violation, some mistake, and they took Annabelle away from us. We'd be beside ourselves. We took her away from her mother and father.
Yeah, it was, you know, what's going on right now, it's so hard to fathom because it's so cruel. And and you know, to think that children have been lost and they can't reconnect with their parents shows a real, just beyond disorganization, it does show that something that, you know, some major problems that are really happening right now that go beyond just politics.
Lack of empathy, and it was really operating a reign of terror down there on the border, trying to terrorize people that have very legitimate reasons for coming in. And the other people are just looking for a better life and work. They're fleeing. They come from beautiful places that have culture, but where things have collapsed. And they have reason to fear for their lives, and they're just trying to get their families to a safer place. And they're punished more by not trying to come into the country. We should embrace them.
Right. I agree. And I feel that, you know, unfortunately, some of the politicians are judging countries that may not be as wealthy or may not have the advantages that we have here in the United States as less than. And, you know, we all know that every person counts and every person is worthy and every person, you know, wants to have a better life for themselves and their families. The injustices that are going on right now, what kind of advice would you give to people that have, you know, anger, but want to do something positive to make a difference?
The only thing we can do right now is vote and hope that our votes are counted. But I don't know what else to do. You know, there are good organizations that are helping. The American Civil Liberties Union as well as suing in the courts on behalf of these children. I think they do a really good job. There are a couple of really good organizations. There's some good organizations at the border that I've been involved with. I've gone across the border and seen what happens when they throw people back out over the border, like PC use Kleenex. But, you know, they're just in homeless camps. They're just stranded with no family, no money, no phone, in some cases, no shoes.
Yeah, it is just, it's hard to think about, but it's a reality that we all need to really acknowledge. Is there any advice that you would give to musicians as a way to make a positive difference during this time of like racial injustice and strife and just in general with our political climate?
Well, I think we have to examine our own consciousness, consciences, and see what part of systemic racism we're guilty of as individuals. Everybody's guilty of it. Everybody. It's so deeply ingrained. And look for ways that you can make a difference. You know, when you see somebody, give them a break. If they're a minority, give them two breaks.
I'm going to make a little switch here. You know, there were times where I've read that it sounded like, despite your great success, you had insecurities, you know, as you were going through your career. How would you suggest artists gain confidence when they are, you know, troubled with insecurities?
I always turn back to the work and just do the work as well as you can.
Okay. And I did read that you were, you know, a perfectionist, which, you know, is really having to do with getting things right with your work and feeling good about it. So I could see
I'll have a sound in my head. And I try to get what comes back off the tape to match what the sound in my head is.
Okay. Well, you know, you had a really unique way of taking other people's songs and making them different, making them your own, or putting a different spin on it. And one thing that I really admired about you is that, you know, you took songs that may have already been popular, but, you know, you put your Linda Ronstadt stamp on it, and then it became popular in a different way.
Well, they were good songs to start with. I think you can't. It's garbage in, garbage out. You know, you can't make a good record out of a bad song. They were just songs that I liked, that I felt like singing.
Were there ones that were more personal to you when you think back?
Well, they were all personal to me. You know, a good song can last over seasons. Like, sometimes it can be about a boyfriend, sometimes it can be about went to the store to buy pickles and they didn't have the kind you liked and so you're pissed. Sometimes it could be about wanting to change your life situation. But it always is very personal about something. The point is not to impose my personal reasons. It's for it to evoke your own particular emotions. Otherwise it's not working. To evoke the listener's emotions.
Well, you did a great job of that, because every song seems to have a heartfelt energy to it, and I always love that. Now, you have two children, Mary Clementine and Carlos, and you adopted them later in life. I was wondering, how do your children play a part in your mental wellness?
My kids are good. I got a break. My son has a good job. He's been able to work from home during COVID. It's been fine. My daughter is a visual artist. She's starting to get money for her paintings, which is nice. I was mostly retired by the time they were adopted. I only went out in the summertime when they could come with me when they were out of school.
Well, they must be. Are they in their 20s now? Or?
Yeah.
Okay. Well, you know, I'm really curious because when your children came into your life, you know, you had your career. And this is a question that a lot of women, you know, who raise their children as single mothers have, which is, how did you balance your work life and your home life?
I didn't have to. I was mostly retired. So I had a lot of time to spend with them, his children.
Oh, that's great. Okay. You know, I read that in 2009, you performed your final show. And, you know, you said that after that show, that every show that you did flashed before your eyes like a movie. And when you went home that night, you burned all your stage clothes. Now, what was the feeling of knowing that that would be your last professional performance?
Well, immense relief, I would say.
Oh, it was relief. Okay.
I like recording. I miss singing. But I remember singing on the stage. I miss singing in the living room with family members or friends or Emmylou Harris. I sing with her over the phone. You know, I have dear, dear singing friends. Aaron Neville, I love to sing with him. I can't sing anymore, but nothing I can do about it. I had a long turn at the trough.
Well, you know, I did see you sing with your nephew. And
that wasn't really singing. That was just oinking.
Oh, you're oinking. Wow. Well, at least you have like that, you know, just the feeling of singing just brings so much joy, especially when you're doing it with family. I would think even going through the motions would bring joy, you know, and you know, having that shared.
It's frustration more than joy.
Oh, is it?
But they have, there's a whole new generation to carry it on. They've learned all the songs too. My nephews, my cousins, and my niece, they've learned songs.
Mm-hmm. You know, during this pandemic, it's been good in some ways, but, you know, difficult in other ways. How have you sort of navigated this pandemic? I mean, do you ever do Zoom parties?
No, we don't Zoom. My life has changed very little. I don't go out very much anyway because I'm disabled. So mm-hmm. I stay home. I'm very happy at home. I'm not bored. I have a lot of friends and family coming to visit, ones that I can trust and are certified clean. And it's been really nice. It's just a lot of time to read. It hasn't been so nice for some people I know, especially restaurant owners and ballet dancers and opera singers. It's been a disaster. It's been catastrophic. But for me, I've had very little change in my life.
Okay, and I'm glad that you have all these wonderful books that you've been probably wanting to read forever, right? And you just never had the time to do it.
I've always had the time to read. I always make time.
Oh, that's good.
I always read for an hour before I go to bed, no matter what. And I read in the morning and in the afternoon.
What kind of books do you normally read, and what has been one of your favorites?
Reading a book on fungi.
Fungi?
Fungus. Fungi. Like,
okay.
Mushrooms are the fruit of.
Ah, you know, my daughter was, she graduated with a biology degree, and we actually went to the Amazon to go look at all of the plants and the, you know, the growth there. So I think that's really interesting that you're interested in fungi.
Before that, I read a book called Caste by Isabel Wilkerson. It's about viewing racism through the caste system. It was really interesting.
Okay.
To be taught in every school.
When you transitioned from stepping away from performing, you said that was a relief to you. You know, after you were starting to get symptoms, you did get the diagnosis of Parkinson's disease at first. And then later on, it was diagnosed as something different.
Right, it's a form of Parkinsonism.
Okay, and it's called progressive supranuclear palsy.
Right, Parkinsonism.
Okay. And it's a form that is a little bit more aggressive or progressive. Is that true?
I don't know. I can't stand to read about it. It's bad enough to have it.
Now, when you first got the diagnosis, you know, you knew something was going on. How did you first react to it?
Well, I went to the doctor and said, what the fuck's going on?
Mm-hmm.
You know, I couldn't sing. I knew there was something. I knew it wasn't the kind of vocal impairment that comes with age. It was systemic.
And when you heard the diagnosis, was the reaction like relief, or was it like anger,
I had the measles, and it was something I'd get over. But since there was nothing I was going to get over, there was nothing to do but accept it.
Mm-hmm. Well, and was that an easy transition to get to a point where, you know, you accept the diagnosis?
Well, I accepted it right away. I didn't have any choice.
Yeah. I mean, I ask only because sometimes we get diagnosed with things and we're like, I don't have that. That's not me. But, you know, you eventually get to the point where you have to accept it and move forward.
Well, that's what I did.
You know, in one article you said, well, now I need to find a support group. Was that ever something that you seriously, like, looked into?
No.
Okay. And, you know, there are quite a few musicians that, you know, get to a point where they might lose their musical ability. Now, what kind of advice would you give to a musician that you know, is faced with something like that?
I wouldn't know what to say. We all lose our abilities. We age. Part of the cycle of life.
One thing that I talk to quite a few musicians about is, you know, when they go through difficult times in their life, maybe they're going through mood disorder like depression or anxiety. especially in the music industry, you know, there's after parties and so forth, and sometimes it's easier to grab alcohol or drugs or something to kind of quell the nerves, opposed to, you know, talking to a therapist. And I did read that there was a time where you had done some cocaine, and you eventually quit. Now, at the time,
I have to quit. I didn't like it.
You what?
Never liked drugs. And I can't drink. I'm allergic to alcohol. So that was a big bonus.
Okay. So you tried the cocaine and you sort of...
Everybody tried cocaine.
What? Say that again?
Everybody tried cocaine.
Right, right, right. And, but you got to... So was it more just for fun, for entertainment, or was it something that...
I tried it and I didn't like it. I found it boring. I couldn't read very well, and I'm not a druggie. I'm just not good at it.
Okay.
We used to get in card games on the bus and poker games, and I always won because I was sober.
All right.
For winning at poker.
Well, I'm glad. It's nice. I actually have an allergy to alcohol, so that makes it easy for me, too.
Yeah, it's terrible. I drink a thimbleful of wine, and my face turns bright red, and I get sick.
That's exactly.
I'm sick for a couple of days. Yeah.
Wow. Yeah. I get bright red myself. My heart starts to beat really fast.
Yeah, alcohol's a drag.
It is definitely can be a drag. You know, as you go through your life and you look back on some of the difficult struggles that you went through, has there ever been a time where you felt like you really had to deal with things like depression or anxiety, or, you know, some people go and experience OCD or post-traumatic stress disorder, any of these things? Was that ever an issue in your life?
Well, I think it's an issue in everybody's life. Everybody has anxieties and everybody has sadnesses and everybody has frustrations. It's how you deal with it.
And how did you normally deal with things beyond exercise?
Turn back to the work and try to make it as good as I could get it.
Okay. And you know, one thing I discovered is that there are a lot of people that find being alone as a big fear. And I know that you had many wonderful people around you all the time, but you know, you had many loves in your life, but you decided not to get married. Do you have any advice for people on how to, like, successfully and happily live on your own?
No, not really. I've never lived alone. I always have family around. I think we're social creatures. Both have family around.
Okay. I wanted to get back to speaking about your Mexican heritage and about immigration. And I was wondering if what it is that you would like government to better understand in regards to immigration and the feelings of Mexicans who want to live their life in the United States?
Well, just so that no human being is illegal, that we're all humans. They're trying to, I think the Trump administration is trying to demonize brown people and make them an object of fear so that they'll be persecuted. It's demagoguery. It's a lot like what happened in Nazi Germany before World War II. They demonized the Jews.
Yeah, I had read that you were almost likening it to Adolf Hitler and how you were saying that the Mexicans are, you know, like the new Jews of that time. Is there anything else that you would like to say about Linda and the Mockingbirds, the documentary?
Not really.
Okay. Anything else that you would like to say about mental health?
No. Have it.
I want to thank you so much, Linda, for taking this time. You have been a real dream.
Thank you.
And I appreciate every moment. This has been like one of the crowning moments of my career. I've now interviewed quite a few musicians and artists. So thank you so much for this.
You're welcome.
Next up, we have board-certified psychiatrist and relationship coach, Dr. Ish Major. Dr. Ish has spent the last 15 years helping men and women find, date, and keep the loving relationships they've always wanted. So let's hear Dr. Ish give us his practical, down-to-earth advice just in time for Valentine's Day. There's a lot about, you know, family history and what you see growing up that can affect your future relationships. One toxic relationship I just, you know, think of is Rihanna and Chris Brown. Ooh. And I know, and yeah, and, you know, but there are a lot of relationships like that where people go back to abusive relationships, even though they grew up knowing that that, you know, is not a healthy thing. I mean, what is it that brings people back to abusive relationships when logically they know it's not good for them?
I don't think they know it. I think they believe it, right? I think the evidence suggests that it's true, that that's not healthy. That probably isn't going to work. But once you know something, then you usually act on that intelligence, right? I know that the stove is hot when I take the pot off, so I don't touch it. I know that. But I don't believe that. I believe it's hot. Let's say, nope. Right? I know it's hot. I'm not touching it. And so in the end, right, we all pick the love we think we deserve, right? Mm. So if we had a good model, great, right? And that puts you ahead of the game. You know, my parents were together for 56 years. I can remember one argument that they had. Not that they didn't have them, but they never let us see them. Mm. Six kids in the house and, you know, seven kids in the house. And they just, you know, they kept that away. And so if you had a good model, great. But if you didn't, it doesn't mean you're doomed, right? It just means that you've got to really get to work on figuring out your lovability, right? What's my lovability? What's my likability? What are those things that I love and like about me that let me know that I deserve something more, that I deserve to be in a relationship that doesn't hurt, right? That I deserve to be in a relationship where they don't put their hands on me in an aggressive way, that I deserve to be with somebody who can say nice things to me and sweet and tender things and not mean things and make me feel less than, right? So those are those things you've got to tell yourself, because until you know that, you will always justify settling for the other thing because mm-hmm. you're feeling less than whole, right? And okay, maybe it's not exactly what I want. Maybe he's not all that great. Maybe she's not perfect, whatever that is means in your mind, but it's something, and something's better than nothing. that helps. And so you really got to work on identifying those things about yourself that you love, right? That you value, whether it was I'm smart, whether I'm kind, I'm caring, I'm generous. What are those things? And then those are your non-negotiables, right? It's like going into a Bentley dealership and buying a Bentley. I'm going to talk to the salesman. I got a list of options. Here's what I want. I want it in blue. I want it with the exterior blue. I want the interior beige. I want the star lights on this roof. And I want a V12 engine. What's the price? And he's going, right? And it's non-negotiable. It's a Bentley. The price is what it is. It costs what it costs, right? So this is it. And now I know that there's value in these things, right? And so there's a level of treatment that I'm just not going to accept. Because if you don't set the standard, you don't set the expectation, how do you know when somebody's not meeting it?
Right. And, you know, I remember when I was talking about relationships with friends and, you know, yeah. sometimes people would say things like, you know, really write down the qualities that you're looking for or, you know, say them out loud. And I think, you know, just going back to what you're saying about programming how we think, we start to really solidify and confirm it yeah. in our minds, and we end up attracting the yeah. the person that has those qualities.
I believe in writing them down, Mary. I believe in saying them out loud. In particular, mm-hmm. I believe in waking up in the morning and looking in the mirror and having a conversation with yourself. Right? Mm-hmm. Yes, this is me, a psychiatrist, telling people to talk to themselves. Right? and tell yourself what you love about you. I love your eyes. Look at those brown eyes. I love that smile. Look at that smile. Because think about how few times we hear that during our week. Mm-hmm. Right? Mm-hmm. It's Thursday. I hadn't heard that from anybody else all week long. Mm-hmm. But, right? And it feels so weird and it feels so awkward and it feels like, oh, why am I doing this? This just doesn't feel right. Because you're just not used to hearing it.
Well, you know, one thing about talking to yourself in the mirror, which is something I have not thought of, but I always felt like if people, like, for instance, with my boyfriend, he'll say wonderful, kind things to me, which is great, but sometimes he's really hard on himself or he'll call himself stupid or something. Right. And I just thought, you know, if you can just be your own best friend, you would never talk to your best friend or me like that. And I guess it's just this thing where sometimes we tend to be harder on ourselves or expect more from ourselves than others.
Also, I think that's really good advice.
You know, talking in the mirror would be a good habit, especially during the pandemic, because we're finding ourselves with very few people in our personal space. And some people also being alone, that's also something difficult to deal with right now.
Yeah. And the big thing there is just realizing that being alone doesn't mean you have to be lonely, right? We've got to be able to, number one, become our own best company and enjoy a good time with ourselves. You know, what are you doing tonight? Well, you know what? I got my Netflix right here. I got my pizza right here. And it's about to be a great time, right? And so you got to get comfortable with that. But, you know, take advantage of the tech. You know, reach out via text. Make that, you know, if your mind tells you to touch base with the old friend, you know, reach out and do it. You never know, right? It's going to help you, but it may be helping them more. So, you know, so reach out and take advantage of that. But yeah, you know, it's a tough time. We're all figuring out how we're going to be okay. A lot of us came to the realization that, you know, what we were doing wasn't helping us feel okay, or who we were with weren't helping us feel okay. And we got to, you know, figure some things out differently coming out of that. But I think one of the bigger things is just understanding how is it that you show up and be the best version of yourself. And for me, it starts with always telling myself the truth about what's going on with me and what's going on in my life. Because once you do that, then those are the things that kind of help move you forward. Yeah.
Yeah. I do find, you know, sometimes it's hard to be vulnerable, which is like really saying the hard truth. Sometimes we're embarrassed, sometimes we're ashamed. But I do think that when people can get there and really express their true emotions, it's an attractive thing to hear, right? Because people can tell, they could tell when you're telling the truth, but they could also, you know, often have compassion for the way that you're feeling, whatever the emotion is.
Yeah. The word that jumped out from what you just said was shame. You know, that's so much of our life revolves around defending ourselves from feeling ashamed. Ashamed of how I look, ashamed of what I have or what I don't have, right? Ashamed of what I didn't accomplish or what I didn't get done. And so if you can really do some work around your shame triggers and understand what those are, you know, whether it's and how you defend against those, right? You're talking about personality types and what how they develop. You know, a lot of our personality is how we defend against shame. My shame thing is not being enough. So if I can just look perfect enough, right? My nose can be straight enough and my hair can be perfect and my body can be chiseled or voluptuous enough, then I don't have to feel ashamed, right? And some of us feel like, well, if I can just work harder, right?
Yeah, you know, I think, you know, we all kind of have an idea of what it is to have a good relationship, you know, trust and open communication. But I'm wondering, what are some things that you can give as advice to couples that have been together for a long time that, you know, to kind of keep the spark alive?
Okay, great question. So we're talking about the connection, right? And how does the connection get severed, right? People say, well, I don't know what happened. We just grew apart. I don't know how. Well, you grew apart because you stopped being curious about each other, right? You felt like you knew it all. You felt like you heard their stories and you know, oh, yeah, that's the story about the guy at work, Bob. I remember. Yeah. I know how that works. Oh, yeah, that's about the person who ran you off the road. Yeah. I heard this, right? So remember to be curious, right? Because our life, you know, what we did last year, we're going to show up and do some new stuff this year, right? We're going to have some new experiences. We're going to take in some new information. And we're going to be somebody new, right? Our cells in our body every 90 days, they're all kind of regenerating and recreating themselves. Our lives are the same way. We're never the same. I tell people, when you see me this week, take a picture, because when you see me again, I'm going to be somebody totally different. So we forget to give people the updates. Like last night, I turned my phone off. I woke up this morning, had a message that said automatically updated, right? New software, fixed all the bugs. We never do that with our partners. We never update them. The stuff I liked 20 years ago when I was 25, I don't like anymore. The things that I needed from you then, have changed. I need some different things from you now. And oh, by the way, I need to update you about what's going on with me. I'm not into that thing we used to do 10 years ago anymore. Let me tell you what I'm into now. But we don't update our partner because we think they may see that we've changed somehow and they may not like it and we may get rejected. They may think it's weird. They may think it's out there and they may not love me as much. And so I might not get the love I need. So I'll just keep it to myself. And so just, you got to remember to keep that connection clear by giving them the update. Download them on the new version. It's 2021. This is what it is now, right? 2020 is gone. No, no, no. Some things are remaining that work well, but this is the new stuff that's coming. And so that's a big part of it. And then the other part is just learning how to be vulnerable with each other. You know?
Yeah.
You got to have that person you can be vulnerable and totally open and, you know, and honest with and trust that what you show them, they're going to handle it with sweetness and tenderness and compassion.
Yeah, I guess that's what we have to remember as the listener is to really be careful with our words or just know that our words make a difference. Yeah. So, you know, sometimes I think like before you answer somebody, you know, take a moment to think about what you want to say and kind of wrap it in a nice gift package, you know, so that it's not necessarily reactive. Because I think that's when we can get into trouble, right? Is when we get hurt and we automatically say something and then it's out of our mouth and we hurt someone back.
My dad used to say, John, think three times before you speak once and you might be right. Right? Because we're reacting because the thing they say make me hurt my feelings, that it make me feel ashamed, that it make me feel insecure and not right. You know, think about why you're about to say the thing you're about to say next. And you know, it's always nice, depending on regardless of who you're talking to, right? And most importantly, when you're talking to yourself, pretend that you're talking to your best friend. How would you respond to them, right? That's how you should be responding to anybody. And certainly that's how you should be responding to yourself. With that same sweetness and tenderness and compassion and empathy, you know, and that non-judgmental way. That's a compassionate response. Compassion is being able to walk into a room where somebody's sitting in total darkness and not feel compelled to turn on the light, right? Mm-hmm. It's not a relationship between healed and wounded. It's a relationship between two equals, right? And I'm just here to sit with you. You know, because you're my best friend. And sometimes you got to be your own best friend and sit with yourself in that darkness with that same level of compassion.
Well, you know, one thing as you were speaking that I started to think about is when we respond to somebody, we give them our words, that there are words that we get that make us feel great, that we, you know, make us feel loved. And then there are words that make us feel less than or make us feel ashamed. That when those strong emotions happen, whether they're positive or negative, to maybe share that with your partner, because sometimes the same things can be happening and we're not saying anything and they have no idea that maybe something that they're saying is triggering us or hurting us from the past or something.
Yeah. Sometimes they simply don't know, right? Everybody, because we automatically assume that they know what I know and they think what I think and they, you know, live what I live. That's just not true. Sometimes they simply don't know. And so there's a very nice and gentle way to say that. Just, you don't have to be confrontational about it. Just, hey, you know, when I hear that word directed at me, you know, it really makes me feel bad. I wish you wouldn't say that to me. Right. And they honestly may not know. You know, when you wait 2 hours before you just simply send a text back, it really makes me feel like you just don't have any regard for me. I wonder, is that true? Or is it just, you know, what, right? You can always ask for clarification because they may not know how what they're doing is helping you feel. They're not making you feel bad, but they're helping you feel bad. It's always simply a matter of clarification. Yeah, I'm curious about something the other day. When we were at that office party and you introduced me as your roommate,
that's an issue.
Right?
You know,
I didn't like that because I'm more than your roommate. So I'm curious about what was going on with you, right? And just see what they say. And you can have that kind of conversation.
Mm-hmm. Wow, Dr. Ish, you know, I could talk with you all night because you have so much amazing knowledge and you like talk so conversationally. But I wanted to know, is there anything else that you would like to say about relationships or about you as a relationship coach? Because you are the premier relationship coach and expert.
Well, I appreciate that. Yeah. My job is to show up and tell folks the truth, right? My job is to just to be the mirror to reflect back to you what you're saying to me, what you're showing me. And I think people have a healthy level of respect for that because it's not something that you can get from folks, whether it's family or friends or coworkers, whatever that situation is. And my job is just to always, the thing that I do that may be a little bit different from everybody else is I'm here, yes, to challenge some of those automatic negative beliefs you have, but I'm here to always help you get to two different places, right? One place is the place where you allow yourself to tell yourself the truth in a compassionate way. And then the other place is where you allow yourself to accept every single thing about you. There can always be things you want to change, right? And agree to work on, but at no point can you show up and reject some part of yourself because that part plays with every person you meet and every person that comes into your life. And if you're rejecting it, it's that much easier for somebody outside to reject it. And so the best relationship you're ever going to have is the relationship you have with yourself. So I help people clean up that connection first, and then we've got a much better shot now at having another relationship with somebody else. And just realizing that no matter who you're with, you're just simply not responsible for the lessons other people are put here to learn, right? We're all the main character in our own movie, right? Everybody else in my life is just a supporting actor or actress. That's just the way it is, right? And understand that 90% of what you do, 90% of what people are giving you doesn't have anything to do with you, but it's all about them. And if you can find a way not to take some things so personal and just accept where you are and who you are and love all of that, all of it, and get comfortable not only giving it, right? Because some folks are givers, but also get comfortable receiving it. One of the things I had to work on personally was just getting comfortable receiving it. I could give it no problem, but it always felt weird to get it back. I was like, no birthday party for me. No, don't give me anything for Christmas. No, don't make a big fuss over me at all. And then I just had to really tell myself the truth about that, it does feel good for folks to make a big deal out of you. And it does feel good to, to be appreciated. And actually, I do deserve that.
Well, that I think is really the key to having a healthy relationships is being able to give, but being able to receive and having that healthy cycle happen and having joy to give to that person you love and having joy also to say, oh, you know, they're giving me this love and I love feeling it. You know, we all want unconditional love, right, from our partners. But I think what you're saying also is having unconditional love for ourselves. You know, right, with all of our flaws and all of our mistakes and just saying, you know what, I am human and I'm trying to do the best that I can. And
it's all got to start there. Right. And we all go through stuff. We're all battle tested and it's the scars that make us beautiful and how we wear them and how we portray it. And so, we'll fly that flag, whatever that flag is, show that scar. That's the thing that makes you you. And it's also the very thing that makes you uniquely beautiful. And so just love it. Yeah.
Wow. What a great way to end the show. I love that. Thank you so much, Dr. Ish. I feel better about myself after this conversation. Thank you so much for being on the Check Your Head podcast.
You're very welcome. It's a pleasure. Thanks so much for having me. Thank you.
A big thank you to the always delightful Dr. Ish Major and the forever talented Linda Ronstadt. For more information on Linda Ronstadt, visit lindaronstadt.com, on Facebook at Linda Ronstadt Official, and Instagram at Linda Ronstadt Music. And for more information on her documentary, Linda and the Mockingbirds, visit lindaandthemockingbirds.com. The documentary can also be streamed on platforms such as Hulu, Amazon Prime, and HBO Max. For more on Dr. Ish Major, visit drishmajor.com and find him on social media at Dr. Ish Major and look out for Dr. Ish on season 18 of Marriage Bootcamp on WeTV. For mental health and solutions for recovery, visit checkyourheadpodcast.com. And if you enjoyed today's Check Your Head episode, share it with your friends and be our friends on social media at Check Your Head Podcast. Thank you for leaving us a review or supporting us with a donation at checkyourheadpodcast.com. So until next time, be brave, ask for help, and be persistent in finding the mental health that you need. The Check Your Head Podcast is kindly supported by DBSA San Gabriel Valley, Lemon Tree Studios, and Blue Oak Mastering and Podcasting in Los Angeles. Visit our website at checkyourheadpodcast.com, where you'll find free and affordable resources for mental health, and where you can also support us by donating or subscribing to our Patreon page. Thank you so much for liking and following us on Facebook and Instagram at Check Your Head Podcast. And the Check Your Head Podcast is sponsored by a 501c3 nonprofit, so all donations are tax deductible. Thank you so much for listening and for your support.